morning, early birds. You've caught the worm, a podcast from Yellowstone Public Radio, rounding up reporting from our newsroom and Montana Public Radio. Considering a remote 2021 legislative session, speeches from Black Lives Matter activists on being black in Montana, and mental health for the National Guard. It's Wednesday, June 10th. I'm your host, Jess Sheldahl. A privately funded nonprofit that manages a nature reserve in northeast Montana is offering bison harvest opportunities for the fourth time. Caitlin Nicholas reports.
American Prairie Reserve will offer 26 chances to hunt bison through an online drawing, the most they've offered since they started their annual bison harvest in 2018. Most of the tags will be awarded to Montana residents, tribal members, and local charities. George Horse Capture Jr., the director of tourism for Ani Nakota Tours on the Fort Belknap Reservation, says these hunts are an effective way to practice bison management.
Since we're lacking of some of the major predators that buffalo are more familiar with from their ancestors' days, sometimes as humans we take that role of being a predator, and management is very, very important, and I know it brings me comfort to know it's still going on.
Last year, more than 2,500 people entered for 16 slots. Those interested must enter before June 30th. Winners will be announced on July 10th and are required to pay a $300 fee. The proceeds will go to maintaining the reserve. The entry form and rules are online at americanprairie.org/bison-harvest. Caitlin Nicholas, Yellowstone Public Radio News.
Caitlin Nicholas is Yellowstone Public Radio's Report for America Tribal Affairs reporter. Montana groups are turning to state regulators to get more information about Northwestern Energy's proposed purchase in the Colstrip coal-fired power plant. Kayla DeRoche reports.
At its meeting Monday, the Montana Public Service Commission rejected parts of data requests while accepting others, notably one that compels Northwestern to hand over previously unreleased documents about legislation that would have extended the life of the Colstrip coal-fired power plant. Had the legislation passed last year, it would have relaxed regulatory oversight over Northwestern's intended purchase in Colstrip Unit 4. The Public Service Commission agreed this week that the utility must open non-public documents, communications, and records from that legislation. PC attorney Zach Regala explained many of the sources currently available are heavily redacted.
There is some in the public sphere, but I think it's pretty limited. And so the rest of it is in the possessions of Puget, Talon, and Northwestern Energy.
Groups including the Montana Consumer Council, a constitutionally established position that advocates on behalf of utility customers, and advocacy groups Montana Environmental Information Center and Renewable Northwest, in their initial data requests, asked for details about energy generation at Colstrip and Colstrip decommissioning costs, among other things. Northwestern Energy previously agreed to respond to the bulk of the requests, but declined to release documents related to the 2019 legislative bill and other data. Northwestern must respond to those requests by June 24th by either providing the information or appealing the PSC's decision. Kayla DeRoche, Yellowstone Public Radio News.
Montana lawmakers yesterday formed a bipartisan working group to consider the possibility of a remote 2021 legislative session. Kevin Trevlin reports that legislators also sparred over the importance of wearing face masks during physical meetings amid the novel coronavirus pandemic.
During a remote meeting, Democratic Representative Casey Schreiner, chairman of the Legislative Council, solicited volunteers to work with state staff on possible contingencies leading up to the legislature's start date. Code Commissioner Todd Everts said state statute already allows for remote voting, which two hospitalized lawmakers have done in previous sessions.
So there is precedent for fulfilling that constitutional obligation to vote and be present by electronic means.
Legislators hope to have something in place before the session begins in January. Lawmakers also discussed how to conduct future interim meetings, which they'll be able to attend at the Capitol or digitally. The Legislative Council ultimately decided it lacked authority to mandate specific guidelines, like physical distancing, but the discussion revealed partisan differences over preferred coronavirus precautions. Republican State Senate Majority Leader Fred Thomas said he won't wear a mask when meetings resume in the state capitol.
My experience in watching mask wearing is it's a hoax to push government compliance more than it is to have anything effective at preventing a disease. Just my opinion.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommend wearing face masks to prevent spreading the coronavirus where social distancing is difficult to maintain. Speaker of the House Greg Hertz and Senate President Scott Sayles, both Republicans, also support voluntary use of face coverings. Sayles said, quote, "A good dose of personal responsibility," unquote, is sufficient to operate in person during the pandemic, considering Montana's low documented infection rate. Democratic Senator J.P. Pomnikowski questioned whether such discretion can place lawmakers at risk of spreading the coronavirus.
If someone is sick after meeting at the Capitol, say 7 to 10 days, and contact tracing puts it back to a legislative audit meeting or legislative revenue or whatever it is, I just wonder about our liability socially and and I guess legally.
Democratic Senator Margie McDonald said she won't attend meetings without mandatory face masks. Representative Kim Abbott and Senator John Sesso, both Democrats, also said they'll continue to meet by Zoom until later this year. Schreiner, who is running for lieutenant governor, wondered why lawmakers should meet in person at all under present circumstances.
It doesn't really make sense to me personally why we're even opening up the can of worms.
The Legislative Audit Committee is expected to hold the first hybrid meeting at the Capitol and digitally on Monday. Kevin Trevlin, Yellowstone Public Radio News.
Kevin Trevlin is Yellowstone Public Radio's Report for America State House reporter. The U.S. Forest Service withdrew its appeal yesterday to a 2019 court ruling ordering it to examine ineffective closures of temporary logging roads in grizzly bear habitat. The federal agency will continue studying the issue. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton explains.
The district court ruling from October asked the Forest Service to consult with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to determine how effective dirt berms are at closing temporary logging roads to motorized use in grizzly bear habitat within the Lolo, Kootenai, and Idaho Panhandle National Forests. There are federal restrictions on road density in and around grizzly bear habitat management areas. The Alliance for the Wild Rockies sued the Forest Service, arguing that earthen berms do nothing to prevent motorized use of closed logging roads, putting threatened grizzly bears at risk. The environmental group says many roads are still usable and count toward road density limits, meaning future road building in some areas should stop until old roadways are effectively closed. The Forest Service temporarily halted one timber sale last year as a result of the case, and in a series of letters said a total of 37 active commercial and non-commercial projects could be impacted. In an emailed statement Tuesday, the agency would not say whether additional projects have been affected. The Forest Service says it expects to be done consulting with the Fish and Wildlife Service on the impact of ineffective road closures this summer. Aaron Bolton, Montana Public Radio News.
A group of Montanans dedicated to forming consensus over the future of grizzly bear management in the state is at loggerheads over the role of hunting as grizzly bear populations expand. Montana Public Radio's Nick Mott reports.
The Governor's Grizzly Bear Advisory Council, tasked with guiding the future of managing the species in Montana, released draft recommendations last weekend. The exhaustive list of measures includes obtaining more funding for livestock lost to grizzlies, securing pathways where grizzly populations can connect with one another, and minimizing conflicts with humans. But the council couldn't find a distinct path forward on how to deal with grizzly hunting should the animal's threatened status under the Endangered Species Act be removed. The draft document lists statements both for and against hunting. In meetings in Helena on Monday and Tuesday, the group grappled with how to deal with that contentious issue.
I think it's okay that you can't come to agreement on that.
Martha Williams is director of Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks.
I think that is still a valuable product from all of your work. So there are going to be places where you may not get to consensus, and identifying those places, I think, helps.
Williams said the state will take into account the council's recommendations, but will not necessarily institute all of them. The bulk of hundreds of public comments submitted to the council online have focused on grizzly hunting, and the council is expected to finalize its recommendations by August. I'm Nick Mott, Montana Public Radio News.
The same nutrition program that provided needed meals to Montana students during the school closures this spring will continue to feed hungry children this summer. Kay Erickson reports.
When schools close this spring because of the coronavirus pandemic, the state's Office of Public Instruction needed a way to provide for students who received free or reduced-cost meals. The office turned to the Summer Food Service Program, funded by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The school year is over, but the food program continues and has expanded, including districts like West Yellowstone that have not had a summer food program. West Yellowstone School Superintendent Kevin Flanagan.
The town of West Yellowstone has a summer recreation program for kids up to 12 years old, from 5 to 12-year-olds. And so we were partnering with the town to provide lunches for them. So they'll call us in the morning and give us a count, and then we'll provide those lunches for them, too, through this program. And then kids who aren't in the summer program, the summer rec program, they can still come and pick them up here at the school as well.
West Yellowstone will be one of some 300 sites around Montana this summer providing free meals. Parents can locate the nearest site by either texting the word food to 877-877 or check the USDA website. The summer food program is open to any child age 18 or under and is free, says Kim Lloyd, summer food program manager for OPI.
This just is a fun way for kids to get out into their community, receive free meals, and it is open to everyone regardless of income or current financial status. So even if you don't feel like you need it, it is a good way for kids to just get out and get their meals too.
I'm Kay Erickson, Yellowstone Public Radio News.
A recent study found a way to identify lakes and other bodies of water in northwest Montana that are at high risk of illegal fish introductions, which can threaten native species. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton reports the study will allow state fish managers to step up patrol in high-risk areas.
Standing next to Foy's Lake, southwest of Kalispell, Montana Fish, Wildlife and Parks fisheries biologist Sam Bure explains that there was a recent report of a northern pike in the lake. Northern pike are not native to Montana, and as a top predator, their presence can lead to fewer native species, like the threatened bull trout or West Slope cutthroat trout. Reports like these help managers' efforts to eradicate a non-native species before they get a foothold.
But in the end, it is hard to detect illegal fish introductions before they establish a population because there is so many water bodies, over 900 just in this region one in northwest Montana.
Bure says a more visible law enforcement presence from FWP can be a deterrent to anglers who he calls bucket biologists, illegally dumping fish to then catch for sport. With so many water bodies in this just one corner of the state, it can be hard to know where to start. Bure worked on a study to identify which lakes are at high risk of introductions. Co-author and FWP contract fisheries scientist Niall Clancy explains that the study used a unique data set documenting illegal fish introductions in the northwest corner of the state dating back to 1953.
Yes, we found that the variables that really made a water body at risk of illegal introductions was the elevation that the lake was at, kind of a proxy for how easy it is to access that lake, what the human population is like around that lake, and then the angling pressure, how many people fish there every year.
Understanding what factors may have led to past illegal fish dumps can help identify what lakes are at risk now. One of the five high-risk water bodies identified by the study is the Hungry Horse Reservoir. Clancy says the reservoir is connected to the South Fork of the Flathead River, which is one of the largest interconnected habitats for iconic native fish species in western Montana. Fish, he says, the state can't afford to lose to invasive species. Trout Unlimited Montana Executive Director David Brooks sits on the Governor's Invasive Species Council. He applauds FWP's efforts to identify water bodies at risk for non-native fish introductions, but adds that the state could further reduce risk by implementing stricter regulations on private ponds, which he says could be a source of non-native fish and other invasive species making their way into area water bodies.
And so there's a whole host of issues around this with private ponds that, you know, I think one fix to consider would be not permitting any new private ponds in this state.
He says so far, Trout Unlimited has not had much success lobbying the state legislature for stricter controls on private ponds filled with non-native fish. Aaron Bolton, Montana Public Radio News.
A Black Lives Matter event this weekend in Billings drew hundreds and hundreds of people who rallied in support of racial equality and justice for people of color victimized by law enforcement. Kayla DeRoche shares words from speakers who talked about their experiences being Black in Montana. And a quick language warning, we chose not to bleep a racial slur in a quote in this story because we think it provides important context into the racism Black people experience in Montana.
James Bullock said he's of mixed race and grew up in Billings.
Being in Montana, that is a predominantly white state, we act like this stuff doesn't happen all over. You know, we act like we see these things on the news across the country. I can see it in Houston. Doesn't happen here. But let me tell you, it does.
He said he went to Skyview High School, and he felt he was reduced to being seen as a Black kid with a white mom.
If it wasn't for my ability to play basketball growing up, I know a lot of people would have looked at me a lot differently. They've told me that. And the sad part about what's happening now and as an adult, I can look back as a kid, I let too much go. There was too much things being said behind my back, to my face, to people that I thought were friends, and I'm learning as an adult, I'm not letting my kids grow up like that.
Lily May, who was raised in Montana and Wyoming, talked about abuse and neglect from her white adopted parents before the age of 15.
A lot of times, I did think my skin color had a lot to do with it. Because of the white community I lived in, everywhere I have ever lived my whole entire life, I've been a minority. There were many days I blamed my skin color on my parents' abuse. Maybe they didn't want me. How can they love a child that isn't theirs, let alone clearly didn't look like them?
May said just before she turned 16, she was placed with a foster father who was a police officer, and that's when she met her best friend. She also talked about discrimination in her school and racially based bullying.
I was one of three Black kids in a school of 400, and everyone thought I was a foreign exchange student. Kids frequently used the phrase nigga in front of me and made sure it was directed elsewhere so they did not get in trouble. Or they would joke and say they would give me a wide eye instead of a black eye. I was called the N-word, I was laughed at and talked about, and the teachers assumed I knew the answers to all of the African-American history questions.
May shared her experiences with local law enforcement and said she's never been treated poorly by Billings police officers. Aaron Thompson, a seventh-generation Montanan, said he was raised by his mother and grandmother.
I lovingly refer to myself as one of those uppity Negroes because I grew up in a white middle-class family with two strong women who weren't able to teach me any different, that I have the same rights, the same opportunity to live a decent life in this country, and nobody should be able to take that away from me.
Ken Palmer said he's originally from Chicago, Illinois, where he said he's been questioned for being in a certain neighborhood and has been kicked out of an establishment because of what he looks like.
And coming out here, I've experienced my fair share of walking down the street and having the N-word yelled at me. But I will say, what I'm seeing today is by far the most beautiful thing I've ever seen in the 4 years I've been living here. And I thank you all for coming. I really appreciate that.
The rally in Billings was one of a handful across Montana held in the days following the death of George Floyd in police custody. Despite attracting different opinions and groups, the events have remained nonviolent. Kayla DeRoche, Yellowstone Public Radio News.
A U.S. Department of Defense report says the National Guard's suicide rate is higher than its active duty and reserve counterparts. DOD says there are several suicide risk factors in the military, including a cultural stigma surrounding psychological health care. The Montana National Guard is testing out one of 23 pilot programs in the nation aimed at getting care to soldiers in new ways. Montana Public Radio's Edward O'Brien introduces us to a career Montana military officer who, during one of her life's darkest chapters, reached out for help and was thrown a lifeline. This story contains descriptions of violence and animal abuse.
Captain Casey Ross shoulders a lot of responsibility in her role as executive officer of the Montana Air National Guard's 120th Airlift Wing. It's a career Ross cherishes, one that mental health issues once threatened to unravel.
Honestly, my youth was pretty intense.
Early in our interview, Ross mentions in passing that she was abused as a child and leaves it at that. For a better sense of where she's coming from, I ask if she's willing to share specifics.
You want me to share some of the trauma and abuse? I can.
And she does. It's heavy stuff.
My dad was intense, you could say that. He would do things like buy cats and then torture them to death in front of us, which for a little girl is incredibly traumatizing. He beat more than one dog to death in front of us after we got attached to the dog.
Captain Ross says she also endured physical and sexual abuse in the home. Any show of emotion would lead to more abuse. To cope, she learned to shut down. That emotional suppression eventually led to panic attacks, nightmares, and depression as an adult.
Honestly, when I picked up my daughter and I realized that I felt nothing for her is when I started to realize that any progress I had made in feeling and understanding love was gone, and I needed to readdress some of the stuff that was going on in order to be able to be there for my kids.
Ross eventually found a therapist she could talk with, but had to quit while attending flight school. After the training ended, the emotional floodgates reopened, and she started contemplating
suicide. Yes, I felt like I was so broken that I wasn't going to be able to be helped. I felt like I was alone in this fight and nobody was going to get it. I just got to the place where I was done. I wanted to be able to sleep. I wanted to turn off all of it, the anxiety, all the flashbacks. I wanted control back over my mind and body. And I was done with the fight.
Ross took part in a new suicide prevention program within the National Guard, piloted in Montana and 31 other states. Because Montana's suicide rate consistently ranks among the highest in the nation, the Montana National Guard was selected to be part of the project. It offers monthly social events and provides training to reframe how the National Guard responds to sexual assaults, treating it as equally destructive as other common military threats. The National Guard is expanding its psychological health pilots this year. The U.S. Defense Department's latest annual suicide report shows the National Guard suicide rate is about 5% higher than its active duty counterparts, 30.6 suicides per 100,000 Guard members. According to DOD, one possible factor is less daily interaction with commanders who could recognize warning signs and, if necessary, make mental health referrals. Dr. Nick Polizzi is the governmental action officer for the Real Warriors campaign. That's a separate Defense Department initiative to destigmatize psychological health care.
The rate of psychological health issues in the United States, depending on the statistics you look at, can be anywhere from 10 to 20%, give or take. This is not uncommon.
Polizzi urges soldiers and the general public alike to heed early warning signs of potential psychological stress.
Having trouble falling asleep, you're having that third glass of wine at night. Over the weekend, you found yourself betting more than you probably would have wanted to on a basketball game. Whatever it may be, that's your body's check engine light going off.
Polizzi says paying attention to red flags and quickly seeking help yields better long-term results than ignoring them. He adds early intervention is also a smart career move in the military.
You know, big problems sometimes require big intervention, but if you're able to address it early, a lot of times for folks that seek care, we know the latest research is over 99% of them don't have a career impact.
Montana Air National Guard Captain Casey Ross, left struggling with a lifetime of trauma and contemplating suicide, chose instead to reach out to her commanding officers for help.
They pulled me in and supported me through that like I never could have imagined. And I think that if people turn to their commanders now, it's the rule, not the exception, that we are understanding to getting treatment and getting help and moving past whatever we're struggling with and normalizing mental health as a whole.
Ross says she's glad the Guard is taking mental health issues seriously and urges her fellow soldiers to, as she puts it, tell their stories.
Mental health is no different than physical health. If we can start owning our stories and saying, yes, I struggled with it, and here is what worked for me, other people can look at that and go, hey, that worked, I could try that. We have to start admitting what's going on, owning where we're at, and sharing our stories so we can start to break the stigma associated with it.
Edward O'Brien, Montana Public Radio.
And that's what's happening in Montana today. Check in with Montana Public Radio's Montana Evening News for updates on the news of the day. For Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Jess Sheldahl. We'll have another episode of The Worm for you early birds tomorrow morning.
The Worm is produced by Jess Sheldahl for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music composed and recorded by Zach Jones at Rapscallion Recording. Meadowlark Call captured by Jay McGowan for the Macaulay Library. Partial funding for The Worm is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montana. More information about The Worm is available at ypradio.org.